So I recently caught up with a few people who are on a national bike trip from Providence, Rhode Island, and they were finishing up in Seattle, and the organization they were with was bikeandbuild.org. I caught these young 20-somethings on a journey for more than just exercise and to see the country, but a journey to bring awareness for affordable housing, for the homeless, for any of us who don't necessarily have a place to sleep at night for whatever reason, whether we're a family who has fallen on hard times due to the mortgage crisis or simply the struggle to survive in day-to-day life and make their rent payments. And so we're going to start this interview here with Alex Ross and David Kim of bikeandbuild.org. And then we're going to get into some music touching on homes and our domicile units. And again, you're listening to Curious Lightning. I'm your host, Dakota LaCroix. And if you want to catch up with us online, please do it. Curious Lightning at Facebook or www.curiouslightning.com. And there you can find links to the music and extended interviews, outtakes, you name it. You can also get in touch with me directly at curiouslightning@gmail.com. And I'll be glad to pass on any information regarding these shows. And last week's show, Pieces, which touched on our suffering and suicide, is archived, and you're welcome to listen to the show there. I encourage you to do so. Let's get into this show, the Domicile Unit.
Indianapolis, Indiana, and we are biking across the country to raise money and awareness for affordable housing. We all raised $4,000 and trained 500 miles. And
did you actually train? Because he was saying he skipped out on it a little bit.
I did. I trained really hardcore. I trained with him right there. I trained with my friend Ron, who's also doing the trip. And we did a week-long trip across the state of Mississippi. And that was 500 miles over 7 days. So our training was really good to simulate exactly what we'd be doing on this trip.
Now, what's been some of the, like, the emotional challenges for you, kind of being out there in this group? I mean, you got to know people a little bit beforehand, but
yeah.
Just for your personal experience, what have you been going through riding across the country?
It's been a lot of fun. Like, I've gotten along with everyone really well, made really close friends, and our group dynamic has been really impressive and really good. And yeah, it was cool. I've met people through the program, but I hung out with them and trained with them some before, but it's been cool to get to know everyone better.
Did you see anything in America that you had no idea, like the speed in which you're traveling? Was there anything unique about that, riding a bicycle, that gave you insight into what it is to be American, to ride this entire country?
Yeah, what I really liked was, like, if you look at the East Coast and you look at where we are now, it's completely different, like, terrain, vegetation, all of that. But, like, it didn't happen overnight. It was really gradual. We started to notice subtle differences, and then all of a sudden we're in a completely different place. So I liked to see, like, the gradual change in the terrain across the country.
I guess on two levels. One, with people, we started, all of us met together, all 33 of us met together in Providence, Rhode Island, where we started on June 13th. And when we got together, the first day after checking in, we started, no one actually told us how to kind of bond with each other, but we started sitting in a circle, and the circle started getting bigger and bigger as people started coming in. And all 33 of us suddenly were sitting in a circle, like, you know, Indian circle, and we're all talking and playing games. And this is even before we started introducing ourselves. And that's when I realized this trip was going to be awesome.
That's boot camp, but what about when you're actually out?
Right. So, you know, with that, I mean, I just realized that people were awesome. That was kind of the initial support. For me personally, my breakthrough kind of was physical and mental at the same time, because a lot before the trip, each of us are supposed to, we're required to do about 500 miles before the trip. I'm going to be honest, I didn't do my 500 miles of training on my bike. I did,
So you just graduated college?
I did.
Yeah,
I know
senior year well. I went to Emerson College.
Exactly. Boston, so. Oh, exactly. So I did a little bit, and I kind of thought, hey, I was training in the flatlands in Michigan. So I really didn't think much of it. And then first couple weeks were very hard. And then there were days when I thought, why am I doing this? Why am I actually putting myself through this? It's so much easier to spend my summer playing golf and hanging out with friends and, drinking, chugging down some beer.
So an interesting fact regarding the homeless is that 40% of families with children are becoming the fastest growing segment of the American population that are becoming homeless. Think about that. An entire family becoming homeless. And so they'll find other places to live, other places to be, including their cars, the streets, of course, shelters. And so something these kids are doing or attempting to provide housing for these families, and it's not a free ride. These families have to put in what's called sweat equity, and so they'll be involved in the building of this home, and what they then get is an interest-free loan to then pay off this home that they've built, this fresh start that they've gotten. And again, this is a complex issue like many of the issues we discuss here on Curious Lightning, and there's no easy answer to this, and I'm simply hopefully taking a peek into the lives and the stories of some of these people who are going through this and the people attempting to make a difference. So let's get to some music now relating to home, and then we'll come back to some more interviews.
yes, I am home. Home is when I'm alone with you. You bought today, staring at the fire for hours and hours while I listen to you play your love songs all night long.
Your fight, too many problems. once stole the stage. They call us irresponsible. Write us off the page. Marconi plays the mama. Listen to the radio. Don't you remember? We built this city. We built this city on rock and roll. We built this city. We built this city on rock and roll. We built this city. We built this city on rock and roll. It's just another Sunday in a tired old street. Police have got the chokehold.
Sunny Saturday, and I'm seeing that bumper to bumper traffic.
Don't you remember?
It's your favorite radio station in your favorite radio city, the city by the bay, the city that rocks, the city that never sleeps.
Gotta get home, there's a garden to tend. There's fruit on the ground and the birds have all moved back into my attic. Whistle and static, the young learn to fly. I will patch all the holes up again. Well, I can't believe that my lime tree is dead. Thought it was sleeping, I guess it got fed up with not being fed. And I will be too, I keep food in my belly and hope that my time isn't soon. And so I try to understand what I can hold in my hand and wherever we are. Home is there too. And if you could try to find it too, cause this place is all grown into wax and mold. Home is wherever we are, if there's love there too. In the back of our house is a trail that won't end. We've been walking so far that it grew back in. There's no trail at all, only grass growing taller. Get out my machete and battle with time once again.
but I'm bound to lose, 'cause I'll be damned if time don't win. I gotta get home, there's a garden to tend, all the seeds from the fruit buried and begin their own family trees, teach them thank you and please as they spread their own roots, then watch the young fruit grow again. And this old trail will lead me right back to where it began. So I try to understand what I can hold in my hand, and whatever I find, I'll find my way back to you. And if you could try to find it too, 'cause this place is overgrown into wax and wood. Home is wherever we are, if there's love there too.
Saying in her sleep, brother's got a date to keep, he can't hang around.
Our house in the middle of our street, our house in the middle of our
house, it has a crowd. There's always something happening and it's usually quite loud. Our mum, she's so house proud, nothing ever slows her down and a mess is not allowed.
Our house in the middle of our street, our house in the middle of our house in the middle of our street.
Something tells you that you've got to move
in the middle of our.
Father gets up late for work, mother has to iron his shirt, then she sends the kids to school, sees them off with a small kiss. The ones they're going to miss in lots of ways.
What is family homelessness anyways? Every year, hundreds of thousands of American families do become homeless, including more than 1.5 million children. These are children hidden from our view, but they are living in shelters, cars, campgrounds. They are young and scared, and their parents and families are often frustrated and desperate. So family homelessness is caused by what? The combined effects of lack of affordable housing, extreme poverty, decreasing government supports, changing demographics of the family, the challenges of raising children alone, domestic violence, and fractured and social support groups. As the gap between housing costs and income continues to widen and housing foreclosures increase, more and more families are at the risk of homelessness. For extremely poor families and those with vulnerabilities of or a little bit of a safety net, even a seemingly minor event can trigger a catastrophic outcome and catapult a family onto the streets.
Economy and the ongoing debate around budget cuts and raising revenues. Billionaire businessman and philanthropist Warren Buffett, who has argued in favor of higher taxes on the wealthiest, cited the growing disparity in an interview on PBS last night with Charlie Rose.
It should be a land of opportunity, and people that get rich, nobody's going to confiscate everything or anything of the sort, but the distribution in this country, a market system has led to extremes. A guy that's wired like me, I don't have any special status in this world. I'm a great nurse, a great teacher, maybe much more valuable to society than I am. I'm wired so that I can figure out what things are worth. Yeah, so, you know, I get super rich, you know, and somebody whose adenoids are in a certain, you know, arrangement gets rich, but television makes a lot of people rich. I mean, you know, Lou Gehrig held out for $25,000 in the late 30s. You know, they benched him. They didn't bench him because he had to break the street, but he had a long, had a long struggle. Television has made the 230 hitter or the 240 hitter, you know, better than Ted Williams at 406. So there's a lot of serendipity. Everybody in this country owes their good fortune in some way to the rest of the country.
NewsHour economics correspondent Paul Solomon has been looking into the reality and impact the wealth gap in the U.S. today. Here's the first of several stories, part of his ongoing reporting, Making Sense of Financial News.
Near Times Square, at the line for late show tickets, we borrowed David Letterman's audience for a short quiz on economic inequality.
So this is three different societies. Uh-huh. It's the distribution of wealth in the societies. Where do you think these three places are?
In each chart, we explained, yellow represents the richest fifth of the population, blue the second richest, and so on down to orange, the poorest fifth. Which chart, we asked, represents the distribution of wealth in the United States?
So this one's exactly equally distributed from the top to the bottom.
In the first chart, each one-fifth of the population has 20% of the wealth. In the middle pie chart, a middling amount of inequality. The richest fifth owns 36%, the poorest fifth only 11%. And in the third chart, extreme inequality, where the richest fifth owns 84% of the nation's wealth, while the bottom two-fifths, 40% of the population, owns an almost invisible 0.3% of the nation's property.
Which one do you think the United States is?
I might say this one.
You think the United States is completely equal, 20%, 20%?
It's not exactly equal, but that might be my guess, that that'd be the closest. Or maybe this one. It's one of the top two.
And you?
Maybe the middle.
Well, the United States would be the middle.
I think the middle is U.S.
Middle one is U.S. Middle one is U.S. Middle one is U.S. Which one would you think the U.S. was?
Hopefully that.
This would have to be third world. This would have to be places like India.
A place that would be incredibly unequal, right?
Yeah.
Definitely. The U.S. would be here.
U.S. would be here, and this one?
I don't think that exists.
At least he got that one right. The completely equal pie economy is completely made up. The middle pie represents the wealth distribution of Sweden. The bottom pie? We asked two presumably low-income workers near the tourist line for Letterman.
What place would have a distribution like this? What
United States.
What
you mean?
What? United States.
United States. Yeah.
Yes, this chart represents the land of opportunity, ours.
The study had a few different parts to it.
Psychologist Dan Ariely designed the quiz. First, consistent finding: most Americans don't realize how unequal our country really is.
People don't understand how much wealth the top 20% have. They actually have 84% of the wealth and they think they have much less. And more disturbingly, people don't understand how little wealth the bottom of the distribution have. The bottom 40% of the US have about 0.3% of the wealth, basically zero, and people think they have much more than that.
But how can that be, given the spread of McMansions and luxury brands in America's wealthy communities, so easy to contrast with almost any poor neighborhood in the country? Harvard Business School professor David Moss.
People look around them at their local communities, and local communities tend to be more equal than the broader society. And so as they look around, that's essentially their judgment, or our judgment. I should include myself, see the same thing.
So there isn't that much inequality in Newton, Massachusetts, where you live, for example?
Much less than in the society as a whole.
Maddie McWilliams, who attends high school in upscale Newton, agrees.
It's getting easier for people to ignore the inequality. They can stay far away from it.
Insulate themselves.
Yeah, I think so.
Another reason people don't realize the extent of inequality: most of it is explained by gains at the tippy top, Harvard economist Richard Freeman.
In the last 30 years or so, the share of national income that has gone to the upper 0.1%, not to the upper 1%, 0.1%, rose by 10 percentage points. That is one of the most astounding patterns I've ever seen in data.
0.1%.
0.1%, yes. People sometimes say, oh, the rich, it's the upper 10%. It's the upper 5%. No. This is the 0.1%. Warren Buffett has this wonderful statement where he says, yes, there's been a class war in the United States, and my class, namely the super rich people, have won.
A graphic recent example: this New York Times online slideshow of children's playhouses, which can cost up to $250,000. Meanwhile, more and more Americans, millions of them, can't afford their own homes.
My house is in foreclosure. I owe them at least $100,000 more than my house is worth, probably closer to $150,000 more than my house is worth.
Are they coming to take it away?
At some point they will. They haven't yet, but at some point they will.
And then where will you go?
I have no idea. I try not to think about it because I really have no idea.
Denise Barrent has a college degree from Lehigh University, some master's level courses, and a paralegal certificate. She once had a job at a health insurance company paying $80,000 a year, plus a part-time job just for fun, she says, selling clothes at Talbot's. But for 3 years, she's been unemployed, free-falling out of the middle class and into poverty, living in a well-to-do Boston suburb she could once afford.
Even the organizations that were helping people before have been stretched so much that they're having a hard time helping people.
You mean it's hard for you to find a food pantry?
There's one the next town over. And it was funny, I remember the first time I went, the people were like, well, you don't look like you should be here.
Don't have a lot of college grads like yourself at the food pantry.
Now, I'm sure they didn't at the beginning, but I'm sure they do now.
Barron's situation has deteriorated since we first interviewed her earlier this year, and she said this.
The top 1% is living well, and they don't get it.
One of her fellow interviewees was security guard Bobby Hicks.
15 years ago, I was working as an office products delivery truck driver.
And you were doing better doing that than you are now?
Yes, absolutely.
Though Hicks was born in America, Christy Pierre-Louis in Haiti, her job frustration echoes his.
It makes me feel like the American dream is not just, is not for me. It's just not for me. It maybe it's for the wealthy, just not for me. Because it doesn't matter how I reach, you know, I'm reaching out my hand and it seems like it's still, I'm still just very far away from it. It's like someone literally pulling it as, you know, as much as I'm running after it, they're running away with it. And I don't get my piece of the American dream because I work hard in this country too. I pay my taxes just like everyone else. I work here, I go to school, and I'm doing my best, but still my best is just not good enough.
So the U.S. looks unequal to a Haitian? Economist Richard Freeman is not surprised.
We're high for a poor country in terms of inequality, and we're a rich country. We're about the same level of inequality as China. And of course, China, half the population are rural peasants, are not part of the modern world. And if we were to compare us with African countries, dictators in different places, you know, taking a lot of the wealth from normal people, we would be among the top half of the African countries of inequality. So the U.S. really has reached an extraordinary level of income inequality.
The luxury goods speak for themselves. But who knew that the kids of the wealthy were flying private jets to camp this summer? Okay, to some, this might be cause for indignation. But to others, it's not that simple.
Inequality is the flip side of providing powerful incentives for people who generate a lot of income.
Economist Stephen Davis.
Part of the success of the United States economy lies in the fact that if you succeed in a big way commercially, you're rewarded for that, and the taxes on your success are modest, say, compared to what they are in a country like France or in the Scandinavian countries.
Okay. But as Dan Ariely found in part two of his study, and as our own informal survey confirmed, when people didn't know which countries the pie charts represented, they overwhelmingly chose the one representing a much more equal and yet still prosperous country, Sweden, as the place they'd prefer to live. A function of their politics, we wondered?
We had 7,000 people distributed around the U.S., different levels of income, education, wealth, political opinions. 92% of the Americans picked Sweden over the U.S. When we broke it by Democrats and Republicans, Democrats it was 93%, Republican it was 90.5%. So there's a difference, but the difference is tiny. And one of the possibilities is that when we dig deep down and we ask people to examine their core beliefs about a just society, Americans are really quite consistent in terms of thinking this is way too much inequality and we want something that is much more equal to Sweden.
And so, last question. Which distribution do you prefer?
Which society do you want to live in?
I'm going to go with this one, though.
You want to be in the unequal society?
Sure. Yeah,
wait a minute. On the off chance that you'll be in the yellow?
You can let us know online.
Paul's next report examines the connections between the growing wealth gap and the financial crisis.
Homeless, homeless, moonlight sleeping on a midnight lake. Homeless, 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 homeless. Somebody say,
hello, hello, hello.
Somebody say, somebody cry,
why, why.
Somebody say, somebody sing,
hello, hello, hello.
Somebody say, somebody cry, why. Somebody say,
heed your mama, heed your mama, the sun of a lonely.
Somebody say, somebody sing,
hello, hello, hello.
Somebody say, somebody cries,
why.
Somebody say, somebody sing,
hello, hello, hello.
Somebody say, somebody cry, why.
Kulumane,
kulumane, kulumane siswe,
sinenze njani,
bayajabula basithanda, yo.
Rich boy, all the couples have gone. You wish that they hadn't. You don't want to be alone. But they want to kiss, and they got homes of their own. Boy, little rich boy, all the couples have gone, have gone, have gone. And you don't love your girlfriend. You don't love your girlfriend. And you think that you should, but you think that she's fat, but she's some, she don't love her anyway. And you don't love your mother, and you know that you should. And you wish that you would, but you don't anyway. Boy, little rich boy, ah, the world is okay. The water runs off your skin and down into the drain. You're reading Fitzgerald, you're reading Hemingway. They're both super smart and drinking in the cafes. But you don't love your girlfriend. You don't love your girlfriend. And you think that you should, but you think that you're fat, but she's not, you don't love her anyway. And you don't love your mother. You know that you should. And you wish that you would, but you don't anyway. You're so goddamn young, you're so young, you're so goddamn young, you're so young, you're so goddamn young, you're so goddamn young, you're so goddamn young, you're so young, you're so goddamn young, you're so young, you're so goddamn 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 young. Don't love your girlfriend, and you don't love your girlfriend, and you don't love your girlfriend, and you don't love your girlfriend.
When you were alive, I was never alone. Somewhere in the world, there was something called home. And as long as you lived, I would be all right. There were reasons to win and incentives to fight. I'm smoking again. I thought all that was through. And I don't wanna live like I've faked all that I ever did. And I've grown a gray beard, but I cry like a kid. I was 7 when I sang you rising the bow there in Aunt Mary's kitchen, and I don't guess I know. But it's why I've done this for all of this time. But now playing and singing seems a game or a crime. People have called to find out if I'm fine. I assure them I am, but I'm not. It's a lie. They say in the end your good friends pull you through, but everyone knows my best friend was you. Hey, I've gotten some help. I guess I was afraid. You suppose something will happen when someone is paid. But I am getting better. Once again, I'll be strong. After all, listen, I'm singing this song. I was never alone. Somewhere in the world, there was something called home. Now I feel like I'm homeless, but I will be all right. I'll get through the days, I'll face down the night.
Good afternoon. I am your host, Dakota LaCroix, and you are tuned in to an episode of The Domicile Unit, the homeless and our housing situation in America, or at least a little snippet, a little peek into it. You're listening to KTRT 97.5 in Winthrop, Washington, and like I said, we've been delving into the topic of homelessness. And you know, why are people homeless? Well, the specific reasons vary, of course, but research shows that it's mainly because people can't find affordable housing. And this is according to the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. It's estimated that 12 million renters and homeowners in households now pay more than 50% of their annual incomes for housing. And a family with one full-time worker earning the minimum wage cannot afford the local fair market value of a two-bedroom apartment anywhere in the United States. HUD, which is the Housing and Urban Development, also notes that it generally accepted definition of housing affordability is no more than 30% of the monthly income. So there's our numbers. But families or individuals who pay more than 30% of their income for housing are considered cost-burdened and have a difficult time affording necessities such as food, clothing, and medical care. This lack of affordable housing is a significant hardship for low-income households, of course. And it can prevent them meeting their basic needs, such as nutrition, healthcare, and savings for the future. So this web of healthcare, of income inequality, it all comes together in this maelstrom to create this homeless situation that we do have here in the United States of America. Again, if you want to find any extended clips, a playlist of the songs I've been covering today, please visit me at CuriousLightning.com, where you can listen to past shows as well as a remix of this current show. And please get in touch with me with anything on your mind, any topic that may pique your interest or something I might have missed, which I'm sure is vast in this topic, to say the least. But again, thank you for joining me on this journey, and we're going to get back to the interview with David and Alex very shortly here. So the big picture. While circumstances can vary, the main reason people are experiencing homelessness is because, simply put, they cannot find housing they can afford. Here's the numbers. Here's a little bit of a breakdown for you. There's 643,000 people experiencing homelessness on any given night here in the United States. Of that number, 238,000 people are families. 17% of the population in this country is considered chronically homeless, and 12% of the homeless population, that would be 67,000 people, are veterans.
Veterans Affairs. In black and white, it states the sad truth about many of the men and women who serve this country in uniform. Current population estimates suggest that about 195,000 veterans, male and female, are homeless on any given night, and perhaps twice as many experience homelessness at some point during the course of a year. A grotesque statistic that Senator John Edwards has repeatedly cited during his bid for the presidency, most recently last night.
Tonight, across this country, 200,000 men and women who wore our uniform and served this country patriotically, veterans, will go to sleep under bridges and on grates.
A grotesque statistic, fully vetted by the U.S. government, even under the presidency of George W. Bush. A shaming statistic that, in our third story in the countdown, Bill O'Reilly is still denying and, in fact, laughing at, most recently, last night. His latest, the second in a week, as he made political hay off the backs of homeless vets, a segment with radio show host Ed Schultz. As far as John Edwards is concerned, I think his message is strong and he's got tremendous conviction, but I think he needs a little bit more material than just the two America talk. He's got to get.
Well, we're still looking for all the veterans sleeping under the bridges, Ed. So if you find anybody, let us know, because that's all the guy said for the last 3 months.
Don't kid yourself.
And they may be out there, but there's not many of them out there, okay? So if you know where one is, Ed, wait a minute.
If you know where
there's a veteran sleeping under a bridge, you call me immediately and we will make sure that man does not do it. Does not there.
I will do that.
Okay.
Joined now by Paul Rykoff, Executive Director of IAVA, the Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America. Thanks for coming in, Paul.
My pleasure, Keith.
Well, we know what we want to say here, and it involves suggesting Mr. O'Reilly should go and do something anatomically impossible to himself with that attitude. But do you know any homeless vets by any chance?
Absolutely. I mean, the VA says there are approximately 200,000 of all generations. We know that there are at least 1,500 that have served in Iraq and Afghanistan. Our organization and others are in touch with them every day. I made a few phone calls today to my friends who work in Los Angeles. They go out to Skid Row every day, and they said they're tracking six Iraq veterans alone that are they're living out in Los Angeles. We know there are about 5 or 10 here in New York. So they're there. This is a very real problem. And all you have to do, to be honest with you, if you're Bill O'Reilly, is go downstairs and look out in the streets of New York.
Right.
And you can find homeless veterans living on our streets every night.
Right. He's two blocks this way from where we are. He's two blocks downtown. Three blocks uptown on Fifth Avenue. There's one church by which you see 40 or 50 guys in the neighborhood, if not all at the same time.
Right.
They're there. I mean, you have to deliberately try to avoid seeing this problem. Is that what he's doing? You have any idea what the mentality is? Have you encountered any of this where people don't want to deny it? Because it can't be that anybody's making this statistic up if the VA is even admitting this. It's not a publicity stunt of some sort.
I mean, I don't know. This is the guy that went after the USO just a few weeks before.
Right.
So I don't know what his agenda is here, but we hope that he uses this as an opportunity to focus on a very critical issue. Homeless veterans are real. We provided your producers with video that was shot in Los Angeles just 2 weeks ago. They're out on the streets. We helped produce a documentary about it called When I Came Home. It tracked the life of an Iraq veteran who was homeless living in Brooklyn. So this is a very real problem. We need everybody's help, and we need folks to support our veterans. This isn't a partisan issue. It's not about John Edwards. It's about taking care of the people when they come home.
Is there a way to explain that 200,000 figure and the other one, the 340 or so thousand who are intermittently homeless over the year? Which left-wing, anti-American, secular, progressive, NBC-dominated organization provided that number?
The VA.
Yeah.
The VA, which provides health care to millions of veterans all over the country. And this is an organization that's had a hard time keeping up with them. But this is unfortunately what happens when you don't take care of veterans who come home with severe mental health issues, who face financial problems, and face, to be honest with you, a real lack of low-cost housing. That's a recipe for homelessness. And we're seeing this number rise. And this is an after-effect of war that's predictable, and we need the entire country to rally behind. And I hope Bill O'Reilly will join our outreach folks in a van that goes out to Skid Row just about every day. We'd be happy to take him out there and his crew and show them that there are homeless vets living on the streets right now.
Well, he said, I think what I heard him say was he would arrange some sort of coverage for, and I mean that in a literal sense,
yeah,
not of the television sense, of any homeless vet to make sure they're not homeless tonight. How much does that cost? What does this big mouth Bill O'Reilly owe these homeless vets, 195,000 or so, you know, just to put them inside someplace warm, say for a year? What would the price of that be?
About $15,000 for supportive services.
For one
veteran,
guy.
About $15,000 for room, board, supportive servicing, and the staffs that can take care of them. It's about $15,000. So as a country, if we wanted to multiply that times 200,000, you're at about $2.6 billion, which is a drop in the bucket compared to what we're spending in Iraq every day. So it's really about priorities, and we hope that, you know, we can use this as an opportunity to focus on veterans' issues. Last night was a great step. The presidential candidates finally started talking about traumatic brain injury, post-traumatic stress disorder, and the other issues that we've been focused on for years now.
We'll also probably have to explain to Bill O'Reilly that not every one of these guys, 200,000 guys, lives under a bridge. He may be focused, fixated on that term. The guys with bridges to sleep under may be the lucky ones. Those are the guys who have cover. Those are the guys who have protection against the elements. I mean, they're people who are literally on the streets, nothing above them, maybe a piece of cardboard.
Yeah,
this is not some joke that he should be making.
And they're also families. There are children. We've met some single moms that are veterans that are living on the streets with their kids. And there are actually people living under bridges. This film, When I Came Home, opens with a very powerful scene of a Vietnam veteran who literally lives under a bridge in California. He's created a makeshift living situation for himself. So it's very real, and it's not something we should mock, and it's something we need to address urgently.
And he just doesn't think it's true, therefore it's not true.
Step outside on the streets of New York. We could probably see some over our shoulder right now.
Go ahead, man.
Yeah. have a dollar. In fact, no, brother man, here, have two. $2 means a snack for me, but it means a big deal to you. Be strong, serve God only. Know that if you do, beautiful heaven awaits. Esther pulled my rope for the first time. I saw a man with no clothes, no money, no plate, Mr. Wendell. That's his name. No one ever knew his name, cause he's a no one. Never thought twice about spending on an old bum until I had the chance to really get to know one. Now that I know him, to give him money isn't charity. He gives me some knowledge, I buy him some shoes. And to think blacks spend all their money on big colleges, still most of y'all come out confused. Go ahead, Mr. Wendell. Go ahead, Mr. Wynn. Mr. Wendell has freedom, a free that you and I think is dumb. Free to be without the worries of a quick to diss society, for Mr. Wendell's a bum. His only worries are sickness and an occasional harassment by the police in their chase. Uncivilized, we call him, but I just saw him eat off the food we waste. Civilization, are we really civilized? Yes or no? Who are we to judge when thousands of innocent men could be brutally enslaved or killed over a racist grudge? Mr. Wendell has tried to warn us about our ways, but we don't hear him talk. Is it his fault when we've gone too far, and we got too far, cause on him we've walked. Mr. Wendell, a man, a human in flesh, but not by law. I feed you dignity to stand with pride. Realize that all in all, you stand tall. Go ahead, Mr. Wendell. Yeah, Mr. Wendell.
So Pat Bailey has struggled with homelessness for several years and at times lived out of her car. But that's not the way things were supposed to be. Bailey had worked several clerical jobs and a flood of life circumstances left her on the street. Life happened, she explains. But Bailey has found a refuge in art, and now it's the only thing she can imagine doing. Twice a week, Bailey is among 100 people at the Austin Resource Center for the Homeless, who cram into a tight workspace to paint and draw with the art found from the streets. A volunteer-driven program for homeless. One of the things that art from the streets is about is this creative part of every human being, says Yvonne Bogman, a local artist who has volunteered with AFTS for more than 4 years. With this population, there are so many ways that they are discounted or considered invisible. But with this project, they have an opportunity to come forward and bring out their creativity. They have a voice. And with that said, we have an opportunity with the struggles of whether someone we know who is suffering poverty, mental illness, whatever it be, to express that. We have that voice through music, through song, through art, through things we build, through a simple hello. Even here, locally, we have that opportunity on a daily basis. And I want to remind everybody once again that that expression, that simple reaching out, whether it's through our art, whatever our voice is, does make a difference. I want to provide you once again with that local bereavement hotline for Room 1, which is 997-2050. There's also that national hotline for suicide that I mentioned. Once again, that number is 1-800-273-8255, and that's a 24-hour-a-day hotline. But through the things we express, for me personally, that came about with my father's suicide a number of years ago. I chose to express it in a short film called Suicide Tom. And this little film merely touched on a bit of my father's suffering and the effect it had on my sister and myself. But I can't tell you what it's meant to have people respond to me and share with me something from their own life after seeing this. And for me, it was a bit of an expression, a translation of ideas and thoughts that I had stirring around in me, and I had no necessarily, I didn't have any way to put them into words, perhaps, but I could cut sound and audio together. And in fact, I used all of the imagery that my father had filmed using a Super 8 millimeter camera back in the 70s, and I laid that together with my sister's voice. And so in many ways, it's their story, but as I found watching this and listening to my sister, it was my story as well. And so I encourage you to share with one another in whatever way we can. And one of the ways I'm hoping to do that in this community, in this valley, is, again, for me personally, I'm wrapping what I call the wrist cutter cloth, or maybe I'll come up with a better name, but I wrap this around my wrist, and it's a way of honoring those who are suffering in whatever form. And I encourage that dialogue between all of us. And so now we're going to take a quick little break here on Curious Lightning and then get back to our interview with the young 20-somethings who were biking across the country from Providence, Rhode Island to Seattle. And I caught them for a little bit on their travels through bikeandbuild.org. And part of Curious Lightning's show today has been on the homeless and another way in which we're appreciating home and those people who maybe have fought in a war and find themselves now homeless and living on the streets, or simply found themselves through circumstances that they could not control, struggling to maintain that roof over their head, that basic needs, those necessities. And so we're going to get back to our interview here in our history. Did you see any, was there anything that caught your eye?
We've biked through really wealthy areas and really poor areas, and like along with that, it's just a really diverse country with like all the different geographical types and like economical and cultural. And I've gotten to know 10 different families building with the Habitat homes. And we biked through Iowa, and we saw 70 miles of destruction from like a windstorm. So like that contributed to like our like idea that there's a great need for houses to be built. I think more of a continuation. A lot of people have gotten on this trip and like rethunk their or rethought out their whole lives. But I still have one more year of college at Purdue.
Do you have a story? Is there an example of that? Of somebody?
Danielle, right over there, was going to go to grad school, and now she might move to Pittsburgh. Like, we're just talking about rethinking your life structure.
Can you tell me about that?
Eliza was going to go to grad school in Seattle and then decided to... You were thinking about maybe living in Seattle. And then... but a girl, Eliza, was going to go to grad school in Seattle. And then she did bike and build and thought about what she really wanted to do. Now she wants to move back home to Rhode Island and get to know her family better. So you just have a lot of time to reflect and, like, think about what you want to do. Changed a lot, though. I've, like, just gained a lot in this trip. Like, one of the best things that I've gained is, like, you see a task that's overwhelming, and you know that if you just start doing it, it'll get accomplished. Like, every day we're like, oh my gosh, we have so many miles between us and the host. We have a mountain pass between us and the host. I don't know if I can do this, but then we just start writing, and then we end up there, and it's, like, such an accomplishment that you achieve gradually.
Real quick, the nuts and bolts, how many miles do you have to put in a day? What's the, everybody meets at a checkpoint, like, mm-hmm. what's sun up to sundown, just real briefly?
We wake up and we get a bike at our own pace and with whoever we want, and then lunch is set up, like, this is our lunch stop, and everyone stops here, checks in with whoever's driving the van so that they know we're safe, and we eat lunch, then we go from there, and, like, you can stop along the way and swim, stop in town, stop in coffee shops, play mini golf, and then you get to the host. We are supposed to get to the host by 4 p.m., and then everyone is there together at one host site, which is usually a church, a YMCA, a firehouse, a community center, and then we just hang out until 11 o'clock is lights out, and then we repeat.
What's the miles a day, roughly, here for you guys?
An average of 75 miles.
And so I heard mini golf in there. What's one of the most interesting, or, like, what have you done off that's nothing to do with biking or habitat that's been just...
The other day, I was biking with my friend Danielle, and we came across an accordion festival in a town called Wallace, Idaho. So we went and, like, watched people play accordions, talked to all the people that lived there. They had a little plaque that said Center of the Universe, so we took pictures there. And there's just a lot of interactions like that with locals where you get to, like, get the town flair and explore. You explore different places every single day, and that's what I love about the trip.
Now, this just isn't any accordion player. This is Tony Lovello. He's appeared with the likes of Sinatra, Frank Reynolds. He's been on the show Hee Haw. This guy is the king of accordion. And so these kids were doing some amazing things by going across the country. And hey, they got a little accordion music from the gig as well.
It's not just me. I'm just looking around. 32 other of my new family members doing this, going through the same thing, and I see in their faces smiling, you know, and just going through this hard time together, and conquering these physical hurdles together, and that just kind of reaffirmed my faith and my inspiration every day.
Again, I want to thank you for joining me on this audio journey today, connecting us to one another and the environment we inhabit. The show is Curious Lightning, and I'm your host, Dakota. If you like what you've heard or want to make any comments, please visit at www.curiouslightning.com. I want to thank Alex and David, who were biking across the country, for taking some time out for an interview, and every one of you today for listening. Let's communicate, let's stay in touch, let's share in our community as best we can, in whatever form, whatever voice we have. We'll see you next episode. Thank you so much.
Roll away your stone, I'll roll away mine. Together we can see what we will find. Don't leave me alone at this time, for I'm afraid of what I will discover inside. Within fragile substance of my soul. And I have filled this void with things unreal. And all the while my character it steals. That's exactly how this grace thing works. It's not the long walk home that will change this heart, but the welcome I receive with the restart. Which to take this home that is so rightfully mine.